on toward Jack's house. He turned on a side street and rolled as quietly as possible through the back streets until he was on Willow Street, a secluded oil-top road on the edge of town bordered by vacant fields. He parked by a pasture gate, hopped the fence, and walked through the woods. Eddie stopped at a barely camouflaged gap in the chain-link fence and looked around. No one in sight. He crawled through and ran from truck to truck until he was at the truck barn. He flattened himself against the metal building, inched over to the back bay entrance, and looked around the corner. A radio was blaring the latest bro country song, barely drowning out the sound of Kyle and Baldy removing one of the skidder's front tires. A third man Eddie hadn't seen earlier was in the far corner pulling heavily taped bags of drugs from the wheel well. The man's back faced Eddie, and a Dallas Cowboys baseball hat turned backward on the man's head obscured any chance of identifying him. Eddie felt something tap his shoulder. He jumped, lost his footing, and grabbed at the metal wall. Instead of stopping his slide, the slick metal rang like a bell. Eddie looked up from his crouch on the ground. Jack stood over him, his finger to his lips. The sound of work stopped in the garage, leaving only the country bro singing about his truck and a bikini-clad girl.
"Did you hear something?"
Eddie mimed to Jack.
"What are you doing here?"
The music turned down.
"What?"
Kyle's voice sounded close.
"I thought I heard something."
Eddie motioned for Jack to go around the corner, stood, and walked into the barn.
"McBride?"
Kyle said.
"I left my phone in the cab of the truck. Didn't think you'd mind if I came back to get it."
"Well, we do."
The mystery man in the cowboy's hat had vanished.
"It won't take but a minute for me to check."
Eddie walked toward the cab. Kyle put his hand on Eddie's chest. Eddie looked down at his hand and back up at his rat-like face.
"Get your fucking hand off me, dude."
"Or what?"
Eddie laughed, looked away, and with a practiced move, grabbed Kyle's wrist, twirled him around, and pushed him against the cab face first.
"You don't want to fuck with me, Kyle."
"Or what? You'll shiv me like you shivved my dad?"
"You heard about that, huh?"
The distinctive click of a gun being cocked and the cold steel of the barrel on his neck made Eddie freeze.
"Let him go, dude."
Eddie released Kyle and lifted his hands.
"Look, I just want my phone. I think I dropped it when I dropped the trash. It's got some pictures on there I don't want getting in the wrong hands. You know, the incriminating kind."
Kyle rubbed his wrist and stared at Eddie. He made a motion with his hand and Baldy dropped the gun. Before Eddie could open his mouth, Kyle punched him in the stomach. Eddie doubled over, coughing, while Baldy opened the truck door and leaned inside the cab. Baldy climbed out of the cab and held out Eddie's phone. Eddie took the phone.
"Want to apologize, Kyle?"
"Get out of here, or I'll give you a beating you won't forget."
Eddie laughed.
"You can't do shit to me that hasn't already been done. And there's a good chance I'll fuck you up instead."
Eddie grinned and shook his phone.
"Thanks. Michelle will be happy I didn't lose it. I kinda thought I left it in the gas station in Athens."
Eddie walked out the door, around the building, and out the front of the Doyle complex. He walked down the road, rubbing his stomach, when a car pulled up. He got in the passenger side and Jack drove off.
"Don't sneak up on people like that. What the hell were you doing there?"
"I saw you leave the Chevron and followed you." Eddie paused.
"Why didn't you talk to me? Do you not trust me?"
He watched his brother drive for a moment. He wouldn't have trusted himself if he were in Jack's shoes, but still. It stung to have his brother's distrust confirmed.
"Of course you don't."
"Where have you been?"
"On a run to Houston for Michelle. Delivering and picking up heavy equipment with wheel wells packed with drugs, looks like."
"What kind?"
"I didn't get a chance to notice, thanks to you."
Jack didn't apologize. So they're transporting it through the heavy equipment. Pretty fucking smart.
Not the worst idea. Michelle's one of the best operators I've seen.
His brother's face was partially in shadow from the blue instrument lights on the dashboard. He worked his jaw as if calculating. Michelle? Not Doyle, Jack said.
No, man. I know you want JD to be in charge, but it's Michelle. Doyle's rarely around. She runs it all. Legit and illegal.
Matt's not involved.
Christ, no. He's way too straight-laced. Which makes him the perfect front. If she's not bringing drugs through the produce business yet, she will be. It's too perfect a setup.
Eddie pulled a scrap of paper from his pocket and handed it to Jack.
The place I went was down in Pasadena, not far from the ship channel. Guy I talked to said the backhoe would be fixed by Tuesday, ready for pickup. Wouldn't be surprised if Houston Heavy Equipment's owned by Doyle, too.
Jack raised an eyebrow, glanced at the address, and shoved it in his shirt breast pocket.
Why'd you go back?
Eddie shrugged.
To snoop for you. I left my phone in the cab in case they caught me.
Jack looked at Eddie from the corner of his eyes. You see Kyle Grant in there?
Yeah. Did you know he's a member of the Tex SS?
Eddie said. Yeah. Came up when I ran him. How do you know?
Tat. Not surprised, his dad was a bigwig inside.
You knew his dad?
Briefly. Tex SS is a harsher crowd than I expected the Doyles to associate with.
Me too, Jack said. But if Michelle's going to compete with the Pedrozas, she's going to have to be ruthless. What better way than to bring in one of the most ruthless crime organizations in Texas?
Hey, Abe's truck's that way.
We've got one more stop. Think Michelle will be suspicious about the phone?
Yeah, but when I tell her I was making sure they didn't see the naked pictures she sent me, she'll forget her suspicions.
Jack jerked his head around. You're sleeping with Michelle Ryan. Eddie leaned his head against the window and closed his eyes.
Almost from the moment I rode into town.
When Jack wanted to tell him where the hell they were going, he would. In the meantime, sleep. There was a sharp pain in Eddie's shoulder. Wake up, Jack said.
Did you just punch me?
In the time Eddie had been asleep, 10 minutes according to the dashboard clock, Jack's mood had changed from wary curiosity to anger. Get out. Jack got out of the car and slammed the door. He left the headlights on. Eddie looked out the windshield and saw Ellie's lake house, circled with crime scene tape, and understood. He got out and walked to the front of the car.
What happened? Is Ellie okay?
He was staring at the front of the house and didn't see Jack's right hook coming. Eddie's head whipped to the left, but he held his feet. With his thumb, Eddie wiped away the blood trickling from his lip. Jack stood in front of him, hands balled into fists, his expression one of rage. Eddie laughed and looked over at the house. When he turned his head back to his brother, his own right hook came with it, quickly followed by a left uppercut to Jack's stomach. Jack doubled over, coughing. Eddie leaned over him and whispered in his ear,
"You've never been able to get the best of me, Juan Miguel, and you never will."
He straightened.
"You going to tell me what's going on?"
In a weak, breathy voice,
"Ellie found a meth lab in her house."
Eddie laughed.
"I guess that explains how she's so loaded. It isn't hers. Are you sure?"
Jack's withering glare was the only answer he would get.
"Yeah, you're right. She's way too straight and narrow to be a cooker. Whose is it?"
"Yours, probably." Eddie laughed.
"Mine? You aren't serious."
"That's what everyone is going to think, since your prints are all over the house." Eddie tried to suppress his smile. Finally, he was getting the reaction he'd wanted for weeks.
"Is that why you sucker punched me? You jealous?"
"What's your game here, Eddie?
I have no game. Bullshit. You always have an angle, a game, an ulterior motive.
Funny. You didn't mention it as a negative when you were asking me to spy on my boss this morning.
Jack spit blood from his mouth and wiped the remnants from his lips with the back of his hand.
Why would Ellie think you've fucked Julie?
Eddie's smile slipped. He'd been to the lake house once with Ellie, and after killing a bottle of wine, Ellie asked about Jack and Julie's relationship. Somehow, his ramble about his brother's dysfunctional marriage led him to confessing about his night with Julie. It had been a miracle he and Julie had kept it secret all these years. Eddie had been sure Julie would throw it in Jack's face during one of their many arguments, but she never had. Eddie told himself he told Ellie the story so she would take comfort in knowing the kind of person Julie was and believe Jack wouldn't stay with her. Now, challenged by Jack, Eddie knew he'd been hoping for this confrontation.
Because I told her.
It's true.
Eddie sighed.
Yeah. I met Julie at a bar on 6th Street and one thing led to another. Of course, I never called her after. That was a crazy time in my life. She came to Mom's fundraiser thinking I'd be there. I think I might have invited her. But I was in jail, remember?
I left the fundraiser to bail you out.
I never had a chance once Julie saw you. The clean-cut, professional version of me. The version who had potential to be someone. Not that I wanted a chance.
Jack held up his hand. Okay, I get it. He stepped forward. Not since we've been married.
Not for lack of Julie trying, Eddie thought. No, Jack. I wouldn't do that to you.
Then what the hell are you doing with Ellie?
Giving you cover, you idiot. Julie thinks I'm Ellie's boyfriend. She won't look twice at her. Julie's been fishing, trying to get me to tell her who you have on the side.
What?
Come on, dude. She doesn't believe for a second you're working every night. She thinks you're off fucking your girlfriend.
She told you that.
No, but every time she asks where I think you've been, she might as well be.
Jack ran his hands through his hair and looked away.
Thank you.
For what?
Giving cover.
You're welcome.
Jack stepped forward. How many times have you been out here with Ellie?
Once.
That's it.
Scout's honor.
Leave her alone, Eddie.
Why?
You know why.
I want to hear you say it.
Why?
Because maybe if you say it out loud, you'll finally fucking do something about it.
Eddie hit Jack in the chest with his palms
and stop walking around like a goddamn zombie.
Jack stumbled but didn't strike back, pissing Eddie off even more.
I get what you're doing. Faking it with Julie long enough so you can tell Ethan you tried. That's it, isn't it?
Eddie shook his head.
Let me guess, Christmas, right? You're trying to get through Christmas.
New Year's.
God, you're a fucking idiot. Your plan only works if you try. Ethan has to see it, and Julie has to believe it.
I've been home every morning when he wakes up, and I'm home every night for dinner. What more can I do?
Sleep with your wife, that's what.
Eddie got close to his brother.
I get it. You feel guilty, probably because you like it so much.
Jack tensed, and Eddie thought Jack was going to take another swing at him. Eddie squeezed Jack's shoulder.
Ellie's awesome, dude. Perfect for you. You two will be ridiculously happy together. One day. Right now, though, Julie is determined to make it look like you're a happy family. She needs you to sell her story. Give Julie that for a few more weeks. Then pull the rug out from under her.
Chapter 11. If Jack tried hard enough, he could trick himself into believing the last year and a half hadn't happened, that it was a typical Saturday morning in Emerson. He was making breakfast as Julie and Ethan slept in and planning how they would spend the day. Maybe go to the nature trail and let Ethan take pictures of the changing leaves. If the weather was bad, catch an early movie, Sharing between the three of them the largest, butteriest bucket of popcorn available, Ethan going back for free seconds midway through the movie. Of course, it all depended on what time Ethan's soccer game was. Jack had spent hours and hours sitting next to Julie in canvas lawn chairs, watching progressively better soccer. The smell of fresh-cut grass and the thump of the soccer ball being kicked, as much a touchstone for Jack's 30s as it would be for Ethan's childhood. They had been happy. Not without troubles and disagreements, but nothing that couldn't be overcome. Or so he thought. It all started with an argument about money. Money and sex. Those are the two big points of disagreements for married couples, so the studies say. Sex had never been much of a problem, thank God. But money? Well, that was always an issue. Jack, coming from a single-parent home, decidedly middle class, always one catastrophe away from the lower end of the spectrum, was a saver. Julie, only child and daughter of an oil executive who was never told no in her life, was a spender. Julie had read an article about the value of being a stay-at-home mom and that their salary, taking all their tasks into consideration, should be somewhere around $100,000. Jack had laughed. That was his first mistake. His second mistake was forgetting about it. In the middle of a big case, his hours increased, as did his distraction and his patience. His absence gave Julie free rein to stew in all the ways, real and imaginary, Jack took her for granted, which left the door wide open for another man to walk through and feed her narcissistic tendencies with attention and a way out. After she left, it didn't take long for Jack to discover Julie's cheating. Her boyfriends left plenty of voicemails on the phone she left behind, which was probably her point. Julie would want to humiliate Jack as much as possible, to illustrate how totally he had been deceived. But the explanation he preferred, the one that wouldn't wound his ego, was Julie's parents helping her financially while she took time to find herself. They stonewalled him so completely, he still didn't know what they knew, when they knew it, or what their involvement exactly was. They sure as hell weren't willing to deflect suspicion off of Jack when the police started asking questions about Julie's whereabouts and why he had lied and told everyone Julie was visiting her parents in Houston. Jack's reputation in the law enforcement community and the investigators' own experience with their disgruntled significant others meant the investigators accepted the fact he didn't search for Julie and lied because he thought she would be over her fit soon and return. When her parents didn't hear a peep from Julie during the holidays, the investigators couldn't look the other way. They contacted Jack's bosses, who were completely ignorant of Julie's disappearance. Jack's feeble excuses for why he lied and why he didn't let anyone at work know went from understandable to suspicious, with a healthy dose of guilty and pathetic. By this point, he was worried for Julie. He couldn't believe she would let Christmas pass without a word to Ethan. Something must have happened to her. He went to his partner, Alexandra Walker, and asked for help. His partner's plan was ridiculously easy. So easy, Jack felt stupid for not thinking of it himself. He had been emailing Julie regularly. The emails went from confused but understanding, to exasperated, to angry, to bitter, to furious, to the current state. Worried. Jack, of course, hadn't thought of attaching red receipts, so he had no idea if Julie had read them. If she had, the recent ones wouldn't encourage her to come home, Alex said. In fact, they would be excellent exhibits in a divorce. Cut that shit out, now, Alex said. They attached an invisible file to Ethan and Jack's emails. When Julie opened the email, the bot would send her location and the time she opened the email back to Jack. California. That's when Jack knew Julie's parents were involved, at least funding her. They had probably encouraged her from the beginning. Jack, with his Hispanic heritage, his liberal politician mother, and low-class beginnings, had never been good enough for their daughter. Jack went after Julie for Ethan's sake. At least that's what he told himself. Now he knew a big part of his motivation to get Julie back was to send a major fuck you to Tom and Cindy Lucas. He had landed in L.A. with every intention to make it work, despite his realization he didn't miss his wife at all, that life without her was easier in some ways. He was standing in the lobby of the hotel, ringing Julie's room on the house phone, his suit coat draped over the extended handle of his roller bag, thinking of what he would say, when he saw Julie walking around the pool. The bikini she wore was impossibly small, and she looked amazing. Tan, fit, her blonde hair even lighter than usual from exposure to the sun. He'd forgotten how beautiful she was. He put down the phone slowly. A smile spread across his face. The anger, humiliation, and worry of the previous 4 months, forgotten. She looked in his direction and smiled. He lifted his hand to wave, when a man walked up to her, put his arms around her, and slid his hand beneath the back of her bikini bottom. Jack had stared at his wife kissing another man and felt nothing. Back in his Stillwater kitchen, Jack smiled, remembering it as one of the happiest days of his life.
"What's this? Breakfast?"
Jack looked over his shoulder at his wife. She was in running clothes, her hair pulled into a ponytail. Her tan had faded, but she was still ridiculously beautiful. No matter what Jack felt about her, and his emotions were complicated, he couldn't deny the sight of her stirred something within him. He flipped the bacon, bringing back a family tradition, breakfast tacos. She was next to him, rubbing her hand in circles across his back.
"What brought this on?"
He smiled down on her and hoped it didn't look as forced as it felt. "You were right." He almost gagged on the words. "It takes two to work on a marriage." She wrapped her arms around his waist.
"I'm so glad to hear you say that."
He put the spatula down and returned the hug. He rested his chin on her head as he had done 1,000 times before, and thought of how foreign it felt to be holding her. How did he never notice how awkwardly they fit together? She looked up at him.
"Does this mean what I think it means?"
Jack nodded. "Tonight."
"I've missed you."
He kissed her so he wouldn't have to reply.
"Hey."
They broke apart with a smack. Ethan was in the kitchen doorway, staring at them with an embarrassed expression. Jack turned back to the bacon and wiped his mouth.
"Morning, baby."
Julie went around the table and hugged Ethan. Jack could hear the elation in her voice. He kept his back turned and said, "I'm making breakfast tacos."
"Cool."
"I thought we could all go to the Snipe Festival together," Jack said. When Jack first arrived in Stillwater, he had decided there could be no more perfect choice for the town and high school mascot than the Snipe, an imaginary creature used to take unsuspecting visitors on a wild goose chase. It always ended with the poor Mark standing alone in the middle of a pasture in the dead of night, holding a pillowcase. Jack had been the victim of one snipe hunt, headed by Eddie, of course, and had taken numerous other suckers on them in college. The University of Texas had been full of city kids and Yankees who'd never heard of the prank and were easy pickings. Then Miner had set him straight. The snipe was real, a marsh bird expert at camouflaging itself against predators. "There are a fair few on the river and at the lake," Miner said. "You just have to look real hard for them." Jack had heard it before, said nearly those exact words to his Marks, though the bird part was new, with a straight and disinterested face as Miner presented. Miner laughed and got Susan in on it, then Starling. Everyone backed him up, which only increased Jack's suspicions, until finally Starling pulled up a photo on his cell phone.
"I'm going snipe hunting with Troy," Ethan said. "Ethan, it's the oldest trick in the book," Julie said. "He'll take you out in the middle of nowhere and leave you. Because you can't hunt snipes, they don't exist."
Julie poured a cup of coffee and brought the pot over to refill Jack's cup. "Thanks." Jack poured the excess bacon grease into a metal bowl, replaced the skillet on the gas burner. The eggs went into the hot skillet with a sizzle.
"That's what I said, too. Nearly got my ass kicked for it," Ethan said.
He lifted his phone to show a picture of a brown bird with a long beak who blended into the background almost completely.
"See?"
"He's right, Julie," Jack said.
"Have you not been paying attention to the festival signs at all?"
Ethan said, looking at his mom in astonishment.
"No. It's a pathetic little small-town festival that will amount to a couple of church bake sales and the few downtown stores that exist selling their sad little wares on the sidewalk."
Jack and Ethan stared at Julie. "It's a big deal to the town," Jack said.
"They're talking about expanding it next year to include music. At least Olivia says Mrs. Martin wants to."
Julie saw the expressions on their faces and smiled.
"I suppose I should withhold my judgment until after I go. I still wouldn't go snipe hunting at night," Julie advised Ethan. "Unless you're trying to get a girl alone."
Ethan blushed and changed the subject.
"Don't you have to work today, Dad?"
"I officially have the day off. As long as nothing major happens, I'm all yours."
"A family day." "What's wrong, Ethan?" Julie said.
Jack turned so he could see Ethan, Julie, and the skillet. Ethan shrugged his shoulders.
"I was going to hang out with my friends today."
"Go on," Jack said before Julie could respond. "I'm sure we'll see you downtown." Jack dumped the eggs on a plate and set all of the fixings on the table. "I'll give you some money."
"Where's Uncle Eddie?"
"Upstairs in his room, I imagine," Jack said.
"No, I checked," Ethan said.
"I don't know." Jack saw Eddie go into his room the night before. "I guess he got an early start."
"Maybe he's with Mrs. Martin," Julie said.
It was the same disdainful tone of voice Julie had used in regards to Eddie for 15 years. But Jack heard something different in it this time. Jealousy, regret, anger. Jack wished Eddie and Julie had been screwing behind his back for years, so he could end this farce now. No way would Ethan blame his father if something like that came to light. Jack didn't look up from fixing his taco. "Probably." He felt Ethan's eyes on him. Julie put her mug next to the sink.
"I'm going for a quick run. I'll eat when I get back."
"I'll leave it out for you," Jack said. Silence followed her exit. Jack made another breakfast taco and waited. Since Julie returned to the fold, strain had become such a part of Jack's relationship with Ethan, he could hardly remember what it was like before. He realized now it was the strain of lying. He'd lied to Ethan for a year to save his son's feelings about the abandonment of his mother. Now that she was back, Ethan and Jack were keeping things from Julie. He longed for honesty.
"Doesn't it bother you?" Ethan said.
"What?" The taco in front of Ethan was untouched. He'd obviously been staring at Jack for a while.
"Uncle Eddie and Mrs. Martin.
They're friends."
"Why?" "Because you're still seeing her."
"I'm not seeing her."
"You broke it off?"
Ethan snapped his fingers.
"Like that?"
Lie and tell him there was nothing to break off. Or be honest. "Yes. You wanted me to give your mom another chance, so that's what I'm doing."
"Don't you want to work it out?"
Jack sighed. "Ethan, it's complicated. But I'm trying, okay?" Ethan shrugged one shoulder, clearly wanting to say something but not knowing how. Finally, he said,
"It's just, if you really like someone, not being around them is like torture.
Jack paused with his breakfast taco halfway to his mouth. A flush started on Ethan's neck and spread up to his face. He flicked his eyes up to Jack's face, then back down to his plate. Ethan's phone buzzed. When he looked at the screen, a small smile tugged at his lips. Jack thought he saw Olivia's name at the top of the message list. Interesting. He waited for Ethan to finish typing. You like living in Stillwater?
Yeah, it's okay.
Would you rather live here or the city?
Why? Are we moving again?
Not that I know of, but your mom doesn't like it here. Ethan drank half of his orange juice, wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, and put the glass down.
Obviously.
She mentioned it to you.
Every day.
Stillwater is growing on me, Jack said. Who knows, though? They may run me out of town one of these days.
You could be a lawyer, couldn't you?
I suppose so, if we wanted to stay. Ethan's phone buzzed again. Olivia's name was at the top, for sure.
Mind if I go, Dad?
It's kind of early, isn't it?
I'm meeting Troy downtown to do some real snipe hunting. Can I borrow some binoculars?
Sure. Bottom left desk drawer. Need a ride?
I'll ride my longboard.
Ethan put his plate by the sink and left the kitchen. Jack heard him bound up the stairs and back down. He came through the kitchen with a string bag on his back and his camera slung across his body. Keep your phone handy. Pick up when I call.
Okay, Dad.
And he was out the door. Jack rubbed his face. Jesus. One more thing to worry about. Ethan had discovered girls. Chapter 12. The 1st of November festival started how most small-town festivals do, as a way to drive customers to downtown businesses. In 1975, downtown businesses decided the answer to a new, unknown monstrosity of a store called Walmart that had opened in Yorkville was to have a sidewalk sale in the square on the first weekend in November. Not only would it remind the residents of the quality, local downtown shops that had everything you could possibly need without driving the 10 miles to Yorkville, but the sale would also give the residents a chance to get a jump on their holiday shopping. After a few successful years, sales flattened, and someone had the idea of turning the weekend into a festival to bring in tourists from as far away as Dallas. It wasn't easy to find a unique autumn festival honoree when you lived in a state as large as Texas, whose towns had been celebrating pecans, peaches, watermelons, rattlesnakes, ice creams, trees, cotton, corn, blue bonnets, and anything else you could eat, stare at, pet, or harvest for the previous 150 years. About this same time, Stillwater suffered its worst defeat in football at the hands of its main rival, the Yorkville Lumberjacks, and it had just about enough of the unimaginative jokes about the Snipes disappearing after the opening kickoff. To boost the spirits of the dejected team, which would go on to have the worst record in Stillwater Snipes history, the town decided to honor the lowly, misunderstood Snipe, and the Stillwater Snipe Festival was born. The festival decided the best way to head off being the butt of a joke was to be in on the joke, so the festival embraced the ambiguity and celebrated the mythical snipe as an amorphous animal instead of the very real snipe, a shy wetland bird expert at camouflage. Things went on happily for a few years, until Stillwaterites couldn't resist the draw of low prices at the store formerly known as a monstrosity that had become a weekend destination. Downtown Stillwater businesses started shuttering, or were lured by lower rents in Joe Doyle's new development on the west side of town. It looked as if the Snipe Festival was going to be a shooting star, rare, bright, and short-lived. Then the birders showed up to save the day. As it turned out, the Stillwaterites had inadvertently stumbled on the most unique festival honoree in the country, most likely since no one believed Snipes existed. But birders knew. And with only a one-line mention in the back of a September 1987 issue of Texas Monthly to go on, a small group made the trip to Stillwater to hunt snipe. There was a good deal of suspicion and skepticism when the birders arrived in their khaki vests, cargo pants, and Tilly's field hats with binoculars and cameras draped around their necks. And for the birders, there was a good deal of disappointment to find not a birding festival, but a sad little sidewalk sale with an indeterminate animal mascot walking around an almost deserted square, trying to entice people to take photos with him. But birders by nature are an unflappable, patient lot, so they dispersed throughout the area to look for birds and were pleasantly surprised to find enough variety to make up for the fact that not one snipe was spotted. Stillwaterites were so thrilled with the influx of strangers and their money that they showered them with southern hospitality and made the birders feel so at home they would have returned the next year even if they weren't driven by the innate competitive urge in birders to be the first to spot the shy snipe. Stillwater adjusted its festival to cater to the birders while still retaining the good-natured joke of the mythical snipe for the kids. Slowly, the festival grew, and though the square continued to bleed downtown businesses through the 90s, Texas artists arrived at the festival to sell their bird-centric arts and crafts. And though she didn't know it at the time, the seed idea for Ellie's cause to save downtown Stillwater in 30 years was born. It would take outsiders, new blood, innovators, to save her town from a slow death. Unfortunately, change as a political slogan, or even a byproduct of her plan, was toxic in Stillwater's neck of the woods. But Ellie was unflappable, patient, and determined, like the birders. Ellie stood outside the book bank, glad handing and greeting every person who passed, even if they wore a Vote for Joe pin. And an alarming number of people did. It was exhausting, but a necessary part of running for office. Though she had taken the challenge as a way to get her mind off her personal problems, as she talked about her vision of Stillwater, Ellie became more and more confident she was the right choice. Slowly but surely, her message of downtown revitalization was getting through to the town. But Ellie's message resonated mostly with the younger residents, and that was the demographic Stillwater had been bleeding for 20 years. If the fact that demographics weren't on her side didn't deter her enthusiasm, the number of questions about her Lake House meth lab outnumbering the questions on her platform 5-1 did. She peeked her head in the store. Kelly stood at the coffee bar talking to Paige. "Kelly," she motioned for her to come over.
"Yes, ma'am." "Go upstairs and get me some different shoes. These are killing me." "They sure look cute." "I'm looming over men whose votes I need to win." "Fine, fine. Trust my judgment?"
"It's not like there are a lot of choices."
"Good point," Kelly said.
She disappeared behind the door to the side of the storefront that led upstairs to Ellie's flat.
"Ellie!"
Stillwater Mayor Jane Maxwell appeared as if from nowhere, surprising Ellie not only because of the stealth of the nonagenarian, but also because she seemed smaller than the last time Ellie met with her, as if she would fade into nothingness before succumbing to death. If anyone could beat death, Ellie believed Jane Maxwell was the woman to do it.
"What's this about a meth lab in your lake house?"
Ellie smiled. Jane Maxwell had also mastered the art of straight talk. Ellie bet she'd never been good at small talk at parties. She would have been more likely to get on a soapbox and dress down the rest of the partygoers for having too much fun.
"They think meth cookers are setting up labs in abandoned homes, using them, and leaving before the owners find out."
"Hmm.
It's kind of brilliant when you think about it."
"Does Jack think they intended to use it?"
"What do you mean?"
Jane sighed and shook her head.
"Your trust in nature is going to get you in trouble one day. A perfect way to discredit you before the election."
Jane looked across the street, Joe shook hands with citizens, while Mary Doyle handed out vote for Joe buttons to everyone who passed.
What?
Ellie stopped as the idea took hold. Would someone have done that? But how could they have been sure she would go out to the house and find it? She never went out there. Then she remembered the anonymous tip the sheriff's department received about the meth lab in her house. Was it all a setup by someone who knew how ruthless the Stillwater rumor mill could be, and how effective it was for destroying your enemies? Did Joe Doyle want to win so bad he would stoop to ruining her reputation?
Yes, Jane said, reading Ellie's mind. The good news is he's underestimating my power over the city council. Jack doesn't need to worry about his job yet.
Kelly returned, holding a pair of loafers Ellie'd owned for 15 years.
I can't believe I'm giving you these. We have got to go shoe shopping.
Ellie heaved a sigh of relief.
Thank you. I don't know what you're thanking me for. These are hideous. Hi, Jane. They're classic.
Ellie took the loafers and kicked the wedges off, losing 4 inches. She held onto Kelly's shoulder to steady herself while she put the loafers on.
Kelly, Jane said, thank you for being such a good friend to Ellie during the election. I'm sorry I haven't been able to help like I wanted.
Kelly waved the compliment away.
Of course. Where's Marta?
I left her at the fabric shop. I don't know why she buys fabric. She hasn't been able to sew for 10 years. I better go get her before she wastes too much of my money.
Jane looked up at Ellie.
I will see you at the polls.
Okay.
When Jane was out of earshot, Ellie and Kelly giggled and rolled their eyes.
Is she shrinking? I think she's shrinking,
Kelly said.
Me too. She's still a dragon, isn't she?
Kelly said.
You have no idea. Will you take these back upstairs?
Ellie held out the wedges to her friend. Kelly took the shoes and said,
You're a born politician, getting others to do your dirty work while you smile at the camera.
Kelly's eyes shifted to something behind Ellie, and her expression turned thunderous. She turned and saw Jack just before he spoke. Hello? Ellie's knees liquefied at the sound of Jack's voice.
Well, well, look who's here,
Kelly said, crossing her arms, Ellie's shoes dangling from her fingers by the ankle straps. Hello, Kelly, Jack said.
Chief McBride.
She stood between Jack and Ellie, inching closer to Ellie, and as a result, pushing her friend away from Jack.
Are you on duty? It's so hard to tell since you don't wear a uniform.
Jack's smile was thin. As chief, I'm always on duty. But today, I'm officially off, unless something major comes up.
Something major always does seem to come up on your watch, doesn't it?
Kelly glared at Jack. Ellie knew her friend's initial good impression of Jack had been irreparably damaged when Mike Freeman killed himself. And even though Ellie had never confirmed she had a relationship with Jack, Kelly had obviously read his interest easy enough and resented Jack toying with Ellie while he was married.
How's the fire investigation going? 2 more bodies on your watch. Brings the number to 5, I believe,
Kelly said. We're waiting on the bodies to be ID'd, Jack said. Thanks for asking.
Kelly, the shoes, please,
Ellie said. With a final glare at Jack, Kelly jerked open the door to Ellie's flat and stomped up the stairs.
Sorry.
A beat of awkward silence followed, which Ellie filled with more awkwardness. Her anger at Jack had dissipated in the night, and she had woken up mortified at her behavior.
I'm sorry for yesterday.
For what? Telling me you don't miss me, or that my wife slept with my brother. Ellie crossed her arms over her chest.
I'm trying to take the high road here, but don't forget you all but said you didn't trust me to not sleep with your brother.
Jack clenched his jaw. You're right. I apologize. He ground the words out. And Ellie realized with disappointment that the more she got to know Jack, the more she recognized how typically male he was. "Is everything else okay?" Jack said. Ellie cringed. From almost their first interaction, Jack had had an uncanny ability to read Ellie's thoughts. Surely he hadn't perceived the small death of her dream of him as an ideal man.
"What do you mean?"
she asked.
"Well, I..."
He cleared his throat.
"I saw you talking to Jane from across the street. You looked upset about something. And now you have this little..."
He pointed to the place where her nose met her forehead, then to the same spot on his head.
"Crease right there. That's your tell."
She smiled in relief.
"Oh, is it?"
"Yeah."
"Here, I thought I had a good poker face."
"Maybe to everyone else."
"What is it? What's wrong?" He lightly touched her elbow, and the thrill of connection she always felt with Jack pushed her disappointment out of her mind, to be revived one day in the future during a volatile argument, of which Ellie thought they'd have many. He had a temper, and she wasn't a pushover. It would either be a disastrous combination or a passionate one. Strangely, she looked forward to the discovery.
"Jane suggested the meth lab might have been planted in my lake house to discredit me, before the election. What do you think?"
Jack tried to push his hands deep into his pockets, but only made it halfway. Unlike most days, he had worn jeans. Ellie pressed her lips together to suppress a smile. He didn't even realize his habit of jingling his keys in his suit pants pocket when he thought.
"It's possible."
"I can't believe Doyle would stoop that low. And why? Even I know he's going to win,"
Ellie said. "Let's hope not. He's determined to fire me if he wins."
"Oh, Jane won't let that happen,"
Ellie said. "As city councilwoman, would you vote for or against me? Think carefully. Your response will determine how I vote."
"You haven't lived here long enough to vote," Ellie said,
avoiding the question. "You're a natural-born politician." Ellie laughed.
"What an insult. Don't worry, your job is safe with me."
He grinned, and before she could steel herself against it, her melting heart trickled down to her abdomen and hit her with a jolt of desire so strong she clutched her stomach to contain it. "You okay?"
"Fine. Cramps."
Jack grimaced and glanced away. Ellie resisted laughing. Chalk another one up for Jack being a typical man. Jack stared at Doyle across the street and stepped forward slightly.
"What would you say if I told you I suspected Doyle was involved in illegal activities, like drugs?"
Ellie pursed her lips.
"Should we be talking about this?"
"No."
His eyes slid from her eyes to her lips and back.
"Under other circumstances, I would be talking to you about this every night."
She swallowed and hoped her face didn't look as red as it felt.
"Well, it wouldn't surprise me a bit. Doyle's a crook, no doubt."
"How do you know?"
"Everyone knows. We just look the other way because it doesn't affect us, and he's a philanthropist. And he employs dozens of people. And he's one of us. But how do I know specifically? He was like this with my father."
She crossed her fingers.
"J.D. That's what my father called Doyle. Good old J.D. He probably kept my father from being destitute in the last years of his life. I tried to help, but he wouldn't take anything from me. Ironic, considering he spent my entire life trying to take everything from me."
"I'm sorry," Jack said.
"We all have our sob stories. I just have a larger share than most."
She shrugged one shoulder.
"My dad alluded to Doyle's activities, but never specifics. I think he ran numbers for Doyle."
"And Michelle?"
Kelly returned, squeezed between Ellie and Jack,
crossed her arms and said, "Where's your wife?" Ellie could tell Jack was making an effort to keep his composure. "She's around here somewhere." Kelly's eyes narrowed and never left Jack.
"Ellie, you should probably walk around the square, mingle, instead of standing here like a bump on a log."
"I will in a minute. We're talking about Crime Stoppers. Grab a coffee for me, will you? Might as well get some bookbank pub while we're glad-handing."
Arms crossed and a scowl on her face, Kelly went into the store.
"Christ, she holds a grudge," Jack said.
"I think it's more about what Freeman's death did to her son than Freeman dying. Kelly will come around."
"So, about Michelle."
Ellie followed Jack's gaze across the street, where Michelle talked and laughed to a group of people, her "Vote for Joe" pin flashing in the sunlight. Michelle caught them staring, and with a mocking smile, waved like a politician and gave them a thumbs up. Ellie turned away.
"She's devious, manipulative, cunning, and charismatic. She was born to be a drug lord."
"Tell me what you really think."
"I can't stand her, and the feeling is mutual. Honestly, you'd have an easier time catching Joe than Michelle."
"Do I detect a hint of admiration?"
"I guess the way you admire a tiger. From afar."
She cleared her throat. She was done talking about Michelle Ryan.
"Jack, about yesterday, I lied."
At that moment, Julie came up and put her arms around Jack.
"Oh my God, alert the press. A politician lied."
Julie squeezed Jack's waist with her pencil-thin arms. Her head barely came up to his armpit. Jack looked pained, but quickly changed his expression to a smile when Julie beamed up at him. Ellie suspected Julie's teeth would glow under a black light.
"Kelly tells me you're a runner," Julie said.
"I am."
"We should go running together."
It took all of Ellie's strength to say, as genuinely as possible,
"Sure. Awesome."
Though her eyes never left Ellie's, Ellie sensed Julie sizing her up and finding her wanting. Ellie stood to her full height.
"I run between a 7 and 8 minute mile most days. Can you keep up?"
Julie's eyes narrowed, but her smile remained.
"Oh yeah, bitch. It's on."
Julie looked pointedly at Ellie's legs.
"Well, with legs that long, you'd have to, wouldn't you?"
"These legs have also been wrapped around your husband, you manipulative little bitch."
"Long legs do have their benefits."
Julie laughed.
"I'm sure I can keep up. I look forward to it."
Jack was silent, his face a mixture of horror and fascination.
"Don't you want to know what I lied about?"
Jack's eyes widened, and he shook his head conspicuously in warning.
"I do,"
Julie said. Ellie looked down on Julie with a mischievous grin.
"Oh, it was a white lie. I told the other police chiefs that I agree with them about Jack wearing a uniform." "Oh my God, you didn't."
"I did. I did it to see Jack squirm."
Ellie turned to Jack. Poor thing. He was completely lost. He either didn't know the subtext running through this conversation, or was too horrified by it to do more than gape at the two women in his life.
"You better not ever wear one of those hideous uniforms," Julie said.
"Come on, Jack. I've given you a hanging curveball. Please don't be too stupid to hit it out of the park."
"I might have to keep the peace."
Ellie did an internal fist pump.
"That's my boy."
Ellie was past her limit on time with Julie McBride. She was relieved when Kelly returned with her latte and they went off down the street to shake hands and kiss babies for a campaign doomed to fail. Chapter 13. Indoors or outdoors, party groupings always tended to segregate themselves by gender. The men stood together, drinking beer, talking about football, no doubt, and staring at the insanely large smoker hooked onto the back of a Doyle Industries fifth wheel. The women stood by the rectangular table laden with cookout sides. Potato salads, chips, dips, paper plates, and fixings for s'mores. Three large coolers sat beneath the table full of drinks, beer outnumbering water bottles and Cokes 2-1. Amy crunched into a salsa-laden Tostito, covered her mouth to catch the crumbling corn chip, and said,
"I'm sorry about Michelle being here."
"No worries," Ellie said, knowing the comment was primarily directed at her.
"Matt said he couldn't very well use the smoker without asking them, and I said, you sure as hell can. Brian and Michelle don't own it. The company does."
"Really, it's no big deal." Ellie glanced at the group at the smoker. "She'll hang out with the men all night anyway." As if Michelle heard Ellie's comment and wanted to prove her wrong, she peeled from the men and walked to the table.
"Hi, Ellie."
Every time Michelle greeted her, she detected a small, superior smile beneath the outward friendliness, a secret knowledge of Ellie only Michelle knew. Ellie wanted to rip her face off every time she saw her, but instead she smiled broadly and faked it.
"How are you?" "Outstanding. Did you bring the meth?"
Ellie shoved her hands into the pockets of her faded Stillwater Snipes hoodie.
"No. I assumed you'd bring the pot." "Yeah, how much does it go for these days, Michelle?" Kelly piped in. "You're still an expert, right?"
40 years of lies, betrayals, secrets, and rumors shimmered between the three women like heat on a summer highway, while Amy, a Stillwater newcomer, stood a little apart, a puzzled expression on her face. Ellie seriously doubted Matt had ever told his wife about Michelle's stint selling pot in high school. Hell, Matt may not have even known about it. It was one of those rumors substantiated not by words, but by raised eyebrows, knowing looks, and silence. Shadows from the bonfire's smoke and flames danced across one side of Michelle's face.
"You never have been able to take a joke. Maybe you're not very good at telling them." "Do they have any leads on the meth lab?" Amy asked.
Ellie stared at Michelle. The breeze shifted, sending the pine-scented smoke in her nemesis's direction. Since Jane planted the idea in her mind that afternoon, Ellie hadn't stopped thinking of it, and the more she thought of it, the more she believed Michelle was behind it. Jack's suspicions of D.I.'s involvement in the local drug trade only cemented the idea further. Ellie tinged her scrutiny of Michelle with humor.
"There's a theory it was set up to discredit me. Before the election." "Who would do a thing like that?" Amy said.
The fire popped and crackled in the ensuing silence. Michelle's perfectly plucked eyebrows arched above her blue eyes.
"And you obviously think of me."
"Hey," Eddie said, pushing into the group. "Chris wants the ribs," he said to Amy.
She picked up a large aluminum pan and nodded to a second one.
"Kelly, would you mind?"
"Sure."
Kelly followed Amy to the smoker, leaving Ellie and Michelle in a stare-off with Eddie standing between, bottle of beer held loosely in his hand, an expression of amusement on his face.
"Am I interrupting?"
"Your girlfriend thinks I set up a meth lab in her lake house to discredit her before the election." "Actually, your dad. But you make more sense. Your hatred of me is almost as legendary as my father's."
Michelle looked at Eddie and raised her eyebrows, seeming to say, "See what I told you?" Ellie gave an unconvincing shrug.
"But it's probably some meth head who saw a vacant house and decided to use it. If McBride's investigating, they'll never figure out who did it," Michelle said. "It's the sheriff's department's case." "Well, Anne Newberry has more sense than McBride."
"You do know I'm standing right here," Eddie said.
Michelle smiled sweetly up at Eddie.
"I'm not calling you an idiot, just your brother."
"We're twins, you know. Insult one of us, insult us both."
"Hmm."
She raked her eyes over Eddie from head to toe. Ellie rolled her eyes and shook her head. Christ, Michelle was transparent. Even more irritating, Eddie seemed to enjoy it. Eddie squatted next to a cooler.
Want a beer?
Not right now, Ellie said. I do. You have a big race tomorrow?
Michelle asked Ellie, a mocking smirk on her face.
No. You in training?
She took the open beer from Eddie and sipped, her eyes never leaving Ellie.
No, just not thirsty.
Michelle narrowed her eyes and pursed her lips.
Is every conversation between you two like this? Eddie asked.
Like what? Michelle said.
Loaded with subtext no one else understands?
Yes, Ellie said.
Then I'm going back to talk to the men. There is zero subtext in those conversations.
They watched him walk off.
Then where's the fun in that? Michelle said. I don't know.
For the briefest of moments, their eyes, full of humor, met, and the two women were in sync. Ellie could almost convince herself they would have been friends if different decisions had been made in the past. The feeling was fleeting, and the comfortable pall of animosity descended once again. Thankfully, Amy and Kelly returned.
I don't care what Matt says. We're getting a security system.
Amy shoved the dirty aluminum pans in the large trash bag tied to a table leg. She pulled two new pans from the back of her Suburban, unwrapped them, and placed them on the table.
He'll come around, Kelly said. He better.
There's only so much money, you know, Michelle said. It's called a budget.
Amy crossed her arms.
Thank you, Michelle, but I know what a budget is.
Then stay within it. If you want a security system, which is probably wise, get rid of something else, like your heated bathroom floors.
Amy narrowed her eyes.
How do you know about that?
We went over the plans the other day.
Why would Matt go over our house plans with you?
Because I'm helping him finance your dream home. That's why.
What?
Matt, poor guy, chose that moment to walk up and get another beer. Ellie and Kelly moved away to the bonfire and sat down on a log, their backs to the three Doyles. They hunched their backs against the cold, looked at each other with wide eyes, and remained silent. The better to eavesdrop.
Why is Michelle helping us finance the house, Matt? You said we had the money.
We do, but it's not in ready cash.
Ready cash?
It's...
Shut up, Michelle. This is between me and my husband.
Amy, we'll talk about it later, her husband said.
Headlights swept over the lake lot.
Good, the McBrides are here, Matt said.
Since when does McBride drive a dually? Michelle said.
That's probably the Grants, Amy said.
What? You invited them?
Matt's voice sounded panicked.
Yeah. Brian's our contractor and Susan is my friend. Why wouldn't we?
Amy said.
You haven't told her?
Michelle's voice was filled with incredulity.
No.
Told me what?
Matt's voice dropped to a stage whisper.
We're not using Brian.
What?
Hey, sorry we're late, Brian called.
We'll talk about it later, Matt said.
This is going to be fun, Michelle said.
Ellie and Kelly glanced at each other, both uneasy at the new knowledge and the laughter in Michelle Doyle's voice.
Oh my God, those baked beans smell heavenly.
Amy held the pan of beans to her nose and inhaled deeply again. Susan smiled.
Bacon makes everything better. Truer words have never been spoken, Kelly said.
Sorry we were late, Susan said. The beans had to finish up, and Brian felt it his fatherly duty to put the fear of God in Ethan McBride.
Why?
Ellie asked. The women, save Michelle, stood around the fire. Michelle stood by the smoker with the men.
Ethan's spending the night with Troy, and he wants to make sure Ethan doesn't get any ideas about sneaking off with Olivia.
I can't believe you left them alone, Kelly said. Troy's there, and so is Paige. Nothing will happen. I trust Olivia. Anyway, we'll be home by midnight. Did I hear you say you invited the McBrides? Kelly asked Amy.
Yes, at the debate. I'm not entirely sure how it happened.
Amy's brow furrowed as though trying to remember exactly how Julie McBride finagled an invitation out of her.
Maybe McBride was beaten up by another suspect today and left for dead.
Kelly, Ellie and Susan said in unison.
Oh my gosh, why would you say that?
Amy said.
Kelly doesn't like the chief because of what happened to Freeman, Susan said.
I don't see how you work with him on a daily basis, Kelly said.
He's a great boss, Susan said.
Well, he's a shitty cop.
No, he's not, Ellie said.
You can't blame Seth's emotional state on Jack.
Kelly's son Seth had taken Mike Freeman's death especially hard. Freeman had been like a big brother to Seth, helping him with weight training to improve his chances of landing a football scholarship. Since Freeman's death, Seth's performance on the field and in school had nosedived. More troubling to Kelly was the fact Seth had lost all interest in friends and had pulled away from her, too. Instead of focusing her anger and frustration on the source of the problem, Mike Freeman killing two people in cold blood, Kelly blamed Jack. Brian walked up and sat next to Susan.
If McBride's coming, we better hurry up and smoke these.
Brian pulled a baggie with two fat joints in it out of his pocket.
Jesus, Brian, Susan said.
Lighten up, Sue. It's two joints to share among what? 10 people? You won't even get a buzz.
Michelle and Eddie rejoined the group.
Then why do it? Michelle said.
Brian lit one joint, then another.
To be social?
He passed one to Michelle, who took a hit and passed it to Eddie. Brian held the other joint out to his wife.
No, Brian.
Come on!
No.
Do it!
Susan took the joint between her thumb and forefinger, inhaled deeply, held it, and released the stream of smoke. She handed it back to her husband.
Happy?
Brian took the joint, leaned over, and kissed Susan roughly before handing it to Kelly, who took a hit without hesitation. Ellie watched Eddie through the entire scene, curious about his reaction. Where Eddie had been relaxed, his eyes were fixed on Brian and his body had tensed like a panther ready to strike. Eddie McBride was much more intuitive and protective than he wanted anyone to believe. Both joints made it to Ellie at the same time, and she passed them across her body to Eddie and Kelly without a hit of either. No one noticed.
Maybe we can finish them before they get here, Kelly said on its third pass.
As if on cue, headlights lit up the vacant lot.
Speed it up.
Brian motioned for the others to take their hit and pass it on. Instead of pinching them out and pocketing them, Brian tossed the joints into the fire.
Now we'll all get high.
Susan sighed and inched away from her husband on the log they shared.
That was stupid, Amy said.
Great, Michelle said. Now the fire will smell like weed.
Eddie can say it's his, Brian said. Chief won't arrest his brother, or so I hear.
You heard wrong.
Jack's voice carried loud and clear across the sounds of crackling fire, frogs, and cicadas. Before she could catch herself, Ellie looked up. Her stomach twisted at the sight of them, and the realization they were a ridiculously good-looking couple. She hunched further inside her hoodie and looked up at Eddie, unsurprised to find him watching her reaction.
I'll take that beer now, she said.
Chapter 14. Eddie and Jack hovered where the firelight met the darkness. Eddie told Jack about Brian, Susan, and the joint.
Remind you of anyone? Jack sipped his beer.
Dad, I was in Huntsville with Brian's old man. He was a proud wife beater. Think Brian beat Susan?
Jack studied Brian Grant. He had a history of disturbing the peace and a few assaults, all involving alcohol and all involving men, none leading to charges once everyone sobered up. Nothing involving women, especially Susan. I hope not.
Why do women stay with men like that?
Jack could answer with all kinds of statistics about domestic abuse, about the mental manipulation that was sometimes as bad as the physical abuse, but he remained silent, watching his wife. Why had he stayed with her? Because it was easier than leaving. Sometimes it was as simple as that.
What do you think she's talking about?
Eddie said, nodding to Julie. God only knows. Michelle Ryan has been staring at us off